Introduce yourself, please.
I'm Senator Barbara Bollier.
That is a slightly different title. We're going to get into that, but first we're going to hear the open. This is Statehouse Blend. I'm Sam Zeff. We're using coffee and donuts to help us better understand the historic legislative session underway in Topeka. The issues and the people in the Kansas legislature. Here we go. Joining Barbara and me in the KCUR 89.3 production studio, my friend and colleague, Brian Lowry. Brian, thanks for being back.
Thanks for having me.
Now, the subtext of this show is I'm saying that we've moved on, but not very far. Last time Barbara was here, she was in the State House of Representatives. Last time Brian was here, he was working for the Wichita Eagle, and now you're with the Kansas City Star. The Star is still a thing, right?
It still exists. You can get it throughout the beautiful Kansas City metropolitan area. Please subscribe today. You know, support good local journalism.
And online like I do.
Yeah.
Makes it easy.
Yeah, wait till you get our bill for that little commercial there. There's plenty, I think, to talk about. But before we go one inch farther, I'm going to need an update on your kids and your cats. Go.
Interesting stories. My 29-year-old daughter, Anne Marie, is living in Melbourne, Australia, getting her master's in public health. And we love the internet because we can talk all the time now, and it is wonderful. Our son, Bobby, who is 27, has a part-time job now coaching with the Kansas City Blazers, and he is looking for a mechanical engineering job in town.
So are you soliciting for work here for him?
I'm not soliciting. He's doing that on his own. And not soliciting, but applying. The cats, sad to say, our dear Samantha passed away. She was nearly 20.
That's a good long run for a cat,
it was
though.
Fabulous. And she's still the best cat that ever existed. And I will make that claim. The other one's still at home. And life goes on.
Life goes on. There is a lot to talk about this week. And I don't know where to start, so I'm just going to let Brian start.
Well, I think one thing that we saw is that, you know, there was this promised big debate for Thursday. There was going to be this big debate on a tax bill and a budget bill. And this was the plan that Senate Republican leaders had crafted, and they had input from members, and they thought they had a coalition. And, you know, early in the week when you were talking to, you know, GOP staffers, they weren't just going for the 21 votes. They wanted the 27 veto proof. They were aiming high. Like, they were trying to assemble that, and then it all fell apart. And I think the senator will really be able to explain why it fell apart. But, you know, from my observation, one thing that happened was this was a plan that had kind of been crafted more behind closed doors than in the open, you know, even by the Senate Vice President's own explanation of it when I talked to him on Thursday. And when it came out in the open, people didn't like it. And one thing that people didn't like is that included pretty significant cuts to education. And so I think a lot of lawmakers who were at least maybe open to the idea at first started getting barraged with phone calls and emails, and they started looking at what other alternatives. And basically, you know, Senate leaders decided, okay, it's clear we're not going to pass it. We're not even going to have a debate on it. So, and now they've basically told lawmakers, we're not having debates on any bills till you guys come back and pass a budget bill. So it's kind of like, you know, being sent to your room without, you know, any dinner. You know, no TV privileges until you get your homework done.
So we know what happened because Brian summarized that for us. So what I want to hear from you is, what the heck happens next? How are you going to, you and your Senate colleagues, you know, put this House back together again?
Well, I do want to clarify, it wasn't completely behind closed doors. And I think that's an important point to say, that we were approached, but we were given certain options and told all these other options were off the table, when people like me went around and found out there were even votes for other options. So it was doable, particularly when including Democrats in those votes. So what's what do we go on to? It's important to note that our leadership said we couldn't come forward with a bill that essentially included Democratic votes. It had to be a full Republican passable bill. And that is probably not how we're going to get out of Topeka this year. I think we're going to all need each other to see this through for real fixes. So what do we do now? We start talking and trying to meet. I don't know when. We all have committees, so that puts a little challenge. The leadership actually could go around all day. They didn't have committees, and they could do that. So I'm not quite sure how this is all going to come together. It's way early. And for me, there was no real need. We didn't have to pass this now. We never pass bills this big now, and especially when our new legislators, they've never seen a real lively debate on the floor. Mm-hmm. Neither have I as a new senator. And so we don't even have the mechanics of how you do that down yet. And then you move on and say, we're going to vote on the most important bill that we will vote on probably in the next 4 years. Not a good plan.
Yeah. I want to play a couple of clips of tape here from your freshman moderate Republican colleagues in the Senate. First, we're going to hear from John Scoobel from Overland Park and then Dinah Sykes from Lenexa.
In the last month of the campaign, what we heard door to door was fix this mess. And I think that that's what we signed on for, is to fix this mess.
I have to be able to see 1 year, 2 years, and then if I have to make cuts, I can do that knowing the plan is in place to get us on the path we need.
So two things I want to hear from you, Barbara. One, do you feel that you were sent to the state Senate to fix this mess?
100%.
And two, you heard Dinah Sykes say that, suggest that she's willing to take some cuts to higher education, to K-12, if you can get a structurally balanced budget in the next couple of years. Where are you on that?
I want to explain that this vote that they tried to do together was because of senators like myself and John Scoobel and Dinah Sykes, who said we will not take a vote on a rescission bill, which is what our budget bill is called, without having a structural fix voted on and in place. And that was our bottom line. Unfortunately, though, they wouldn't run the structural fix first. So that is partially why some people fell off, lack of trust. Will that happen? Well, I agree with those things. We are all searching for ways to find possibilities, particularly to not cut K-12. And I think it's possible. It's going to take some finagling. It's going to take some more one-time budget fixes, as you call them. But if you have the structural fix in place down the road, that's a lot easier to do than just saying, well, we're going to take one-time money and we're still going to be going down the tubes in our revenues.
So I need you on the record here. Would you consider K-12 cuts, not at the 5% level? Clearly, you're not going to go for that. But if you can come up with a structurally balanced budget, a third tax bracket, raising marginal rates, whatever that may be, could you go back to your superintendents and say, I need you to bull your neck on this, get through another year so that we have something good down the road? Can you take that?
Sam, my superintendent isn't the issue. I have already had that conversation, and our district could weather the storm.
Shawnee Mission.
Problem is, I have 80,000 constituents, and most of those people, not all, but most of them are adamant that we not cut K-12. So it's not just me answering to the schools. Yeah. So to be on record, I don't know. I have to see the numbers. I don't want to cut the schools at all. But if it's the only way that we can get this all passed with enough votes in the Senate and the House, 2%, 1%, that's doable. I would rather not have my vote on that for me, because it's not what my people want. But sometimes, you know, I have described this as Sophie's choice. There is no good out. There's no good vote. I have all kinds of other things that I want to address, like mental health and expanding Medicaid and all these other things. And none of that is possible because of this horrible revenue deficit that we have. So I don't like being Sophie.
and one thing, Sam, that kind of complicates, you know, including K through 12 cuts is there's that school finance case that we've been on this show and talked about many times. And that complicates it for a couple of reasons. One, there's an argument that you can cut education. That's really not a structural fix because there's a large expectation that the court at some point is going to hand the legislature an order that says you need to spend more on education. So the structure would become out of whack pretty quickly. Another thing is John Robb, who is the attorney for the schools that are suing the state for more money, Wichita, KCK, Hutchinson, Dodge City. He maintains that an across-the-board cut would actually put the state out of compliance with the equity standard. And the reason for that...
And back to court we go.
Right. The reason, and that was what we just solved this past summer. And that may confuse people. If it's an across-the-board cut, every district's being cut by the same percentage, why would that affect equity? Well, according to John, who I spoke to on Thursday, that's because what we would consider the schools with more low-income students are more dependent on the state for a higher percentage of their total aid. The quote-unquote wealthier school districts can raise more money from local revenue. And so if you cut across the board, well, KCK, Wichita, they're going to see a bigger percentage of their overall funding cut than schools that can make up for it on the local side.
Right. Student. I mean, these are districts that have more children in poverty, more English language learners, rural districts where a kid may have to ride a bus for an hour, where there's additional cost with that. Barbara, you want to say something?
Well, I want to add in that when we were presented these two plans, we were told that we must have an ending balance for 18 and 19, and that's why we had to do these cuts. And my question was, well, so those ending balances will go to schools, correct, if you cut them this year? And I was told yes, and then ultimately I was told no. So I was getting different kinds of information, and my bottom line is, we have to fund our schools. And so you can't have money sitting in the bank and say, oh, but we have to cut the schools. That will not fly with me.
Well, now, the conservative argument from the Kansas Policy Institute and Chamber and what have you would be that, you know, you got a lot of school districts with a lot of dough in the bank. This is, in some ways, this was this 5% cut, right, that they could use their idle funds, their unencumbered funds to pay for that. So why is that different?
Sam, we would have to get so far into the weeds to explain all of that. In my opinion, there isn't an abundance of money sitting around waiting to be spent. Districts hold on to certain money as an opportunity to then have a larger purchase with that money. Right. You don't just, if you want to buy a car, you don't keep spending every $5 you make that you should be putting in the bank and then be criticized for having a big bank account because you're waiting to buy the car. That's illogical. So, you know, they can say all they want about that, but, you know, and people also to understand about capital outlay money that is separate from state general fund regular money and that we give as a state, and those two can't be mixed. So a huge amount of that money is, you know, unavailable for general operations. So it's going to take another bill, which Senator Molly Baumgardner is proposing, is my understanding, to allow them to use that money. But, you know, you've got to pass that both in the Senate and the House and have the governor sign it. So I can't bank on that till that's done. So maybe we should start there.
I do want to just say that this is State House Blend, and the people who listen to this love being in the weeds. So don't worry about that. Don't worry about that, my friend. Worry about that. Brian?
I just, you brought up getting the governor to sign it. And that was obviously, you know, you and I had a conversation that was something that was kind of hanging over this. Well, I can't call it a debate since there was no floor debate, but this discussion.
this discussion.
So can you just talk about how the governor plays into maybe legislative leaders' decisions?
Well, I wish I was in their heads to understand that, because my understanding is that we have three branches of government for a reason, and that we as a legislature should have a plan. The governor can either approve or veto it, but it is our job to represent the people and to bring forward to the governor what we vote believing the people want. So when we were told in that discussion that the only bill that could be brought forward had to be guaranteed that the governor would not veto that bill, well, I don't see that happening, because we have heard from the governor that he will veto anything that has the LLC exemption in it. Every one of us is voting for an LLC exemption repeal. So that's going to happen. So that's not even an attainable goal. So I that left me very baffled. And my point I made, they also said we had to do it with only Republican votes. And my comment was, every one of us was elected to get up here to fix this problem. And if those who think they weren't, well, that's their district's issue. But the ones I know, we have a problem to fix. And if we can't work together, all of us, to figure this out, then we're no better than Washington, D.C., and I don't even want to go there.
Now, the governor has had kind of a, let's just say, fraught relationship with Senate leadership. You know, he and Susan Weigel used to be pretty close allies.
Now they're at each other's throats.
Yeah, they've been whacking at each other in the press for more than a year now at this point. You don't get the sense that they're talking a lot. But what I do hear is that the governor is talking to the House side. So that's actually, I think, the thing that we should really watch this week, is things right now seem a little bit stalled in the Senate for
a bit.
But it sounds like
I think they're in the ditch is where I think you're not beyond stalled.
I was being diplomatic. But it sounds like the governor's been talking to House leadership. I think the House, you might see, I don't know if you'll see a tax vote from the House, although there is a tax plan that did pass out of the committee the other day. But you may see a rescission bill emerge in the House, and that may actually be closer to the one that the governor proposed at the start of the session. And so it'll be very interesting to see if that can pass the House, and then if it does, what the Senate does with it. Because Senate leaders do not like the governor's plan, because they don't...
It doesn't match what the Senate wants.
Essentially, it's just the governor's plan is, let's tap these long-term investment funds, let's reduce our annual CAPERS payment. This phrase structural fix, I think very few people look at the governor's plan and see a structural fix.
There is not one. Now, I do have some inside scoop that I saved just for this morning.
Well, then dish
away,
my friend.
My understanding, I was told that on Tuesday we will put the Democratic tax plan through the tax committee and pass it out and run it on Thursday.
On the floor?
On the floor.
What's the Democratic tax plan?
My understanding, primarily, it is a three-bracketed tax plan. I don't have the numbers in front of me. It included a 6.45% mm-hmm. tax on an upper bracket, and as I recall, no change or minimal to the lowest bracket, and a very minimal change to the middle bracket, which would be, they would be new ones, essentially based, and they were going to raise to $70,000 base, where the upper bracket would start instead of $60,000, and I can't remember the rest.
I've got some of the details on that. So first, among other things, they are actually going to one thing that the legislature did do in recent years is get rid of a lot of deductions or reduce those values. The Democrats would actually restore those deductions, but they are going to play with the rates. And the key, as the senator said, is that there will be a top rate of 6.45%. And what the talking point will be that that's the tax on high-income Kansans. Now, that said, I think a lot of Kansans who will fall into that category won't necessarily consider themselves high-income Kansans, because for a single person, it's $35,000 or more a year, and for a married couple, it's $70,000. Now, that's higher than what the highest bracket was before Brownback, but it still is something that I think, you know, that's one thing when we look at the tax bracket, so that somebody who's making $40,000 is going to be viewed the same as someone who's making $400,000. And so I think there still will be a little bit of a debate about really where you make that threshold for the quote unquote high income Kansan.
Right.
Now, I'm not wrong. I mean, moderates in the Senate are not opposed to a third income tax bracket, right? This is something that you guys could, right. You
Very
guys could
supportive.
Live with that.
And interestingly, I think it's important to remember that when this whole march to zero, no income tax came into play, none of us, at least when I was an elected official as a representative, none of my constituents were coming to me going, oh my goodness, Kansas income tax is so high, please cut it, please cut it. They were all shocked when this came about. And that's how I know that at least in my district, people going door to door were saying, I want to pay fair income tax. Let me pay it. Now, I know that in everybody in the state, and I have people writing me that say, don't tax me more. But some of those people, they're in that very low bracket. And the answer is, well, then we're going to do our best. And but we have to have money in the state. We have a revenue crisis. Our bond ratings are going down. It is a disaster, and we cannot continue on this path.
And the third bracket will be, I think, as far as the tax debate goes, that will be the debate of the session, because we now have consensus on what has become the most politically toxic part of the governor's tax plan, which was the exemption for business owners. I think everyone, the idea that you have some people who are paying zero tax on their income, I think, has rubbed everyone the wrong way. And then it's really the question is, what do you do with rates? Because if you go with the GOP leadership plan, you have an increase to rates, but you don't create this three-bracket system. The Democrats are trying to bring back a three-bracket system, which is what Kansas had for years and years and years, with some slight tweaks. And that's going to be kind of the real question of what do they do, and the plan that passed out of the House is also a three bracket
exactly.
plan, but it's not as high a tax rate as the Democrats. So
right.
there seems to be a big idea of we do need to restore the third tax bracket, because that's actually arguably where Kansas lost the most amount of revenue.
It's not even arguably.
Yeah.
We 70% yeah. was what was it was a 70% on the income tax, 30% on the LLC exemption. It's clear that's where the money is.
Before we get off this topic, I want to stay on politics just for a second. I have to say that I was on the floor on Thursday morning, and after everything imploded and you gaveled out, it sure looked to me like leadership was putting a lot of pressure and doing a lot of arm twisting of members to get them to try to get them over to their point of view. I've even heard that a couple of members were threatened with a primary 2 or 4 years down the road. Are you feeling that arm twisting or seeing that arm twisting?
Totally. And you're making me laugh, Sam, because I am not in the legislature to be reelected. I'm there to get the job done. Threaten me all you want. They told me all this money would come from the Koch brothers, millions of dollars to attack me in a campaign. Somebody from St. Louis had lots of money ready to go to get me out of office if I didn't vote for these measures or wanted three brackets of income tax.
Is that man's name Rex?
Yeah, what would his name be? Anyway, and I just
said— And just to be clear, he's not a Kansan, is he?
It doesn't matter. They
okay.
all have a little—
He lives in Missouri.
They have, yeah, they have interests somehow. And my point back to them was, thank you very much. If I'm not here, I'm not. I'll just be moving on towards retirement and life, and I have plenty to do. And I'm not here to be threatened. I'm here to get it fixed and whatever it takes. If I do the right thing, I will be reelected because that's what my constituents want.
One word of advice I'll give to lawmakers after observing the legislature is you're all going to get primaried.
Postcarded.
If you're a Republican in Johnson County, whether you're a conservative or a moderate, you're going to get primary.
I'm just saying that, you guys have been there.
Yeah. I've been there and done that. I got taken off committees. I've got everything. Do it to me. I'm there to try to work hard.
You've been there for a while, but just in the Senate for, 3
weeks.
Right. And, some of your fresh, I can't even believe that all their boxes are unpacked, and they're already being threatened with a primary by leadership.
And
4 years down the road.
The moderates' comment right back to them was, we don't care. Go for it. We are here to fix things. None of us are here. We didn't run in this election thinking we are doing this so we can get reelected. We came to fix things, and that's our goal.
And arguably, Johnson County, if your goal is to get reelected, I know you've got more altruistic motivations than that, but I'll be cynical for a second. Arguably, a cut to schools in Johnson County is not the best politically tactical decision that you could make.
I can pick my 3 people in leadership mad at me, or I can pick 80,000 people. Now, which would you pick? I want to support my people.
I think they call that. I'm not a lawyer, mind you, but I think they call that the preponderance of evidence. But I'm not I'm not quite sure. Let me move on to. There was a lot of talk of CanCare and Medicaid expansion rallies this past week. I think this coming week. On the committee that you vice chair, Public Health and Welfare, you're taking up a bill that would change the way the state interacts with CanCare providers. Talk a little bit about that, and then I want to move on to what you think are the chances of actually expanding Medicaid in the political climate here, and then clearly the political climate in Washington. So, what's the bill that's coming up this
week?
How
much time do I have?
Okay.
So,
don't be afraid of the weeds.
The bill.
My
I'm not afraid of the weeds. The bill. Senate Bill 69, which is a CanCare reform bill, deals with various issues. For instance, having an application consolidated for all doctors to get credentialed and all providers through one system instead of having to do it through each managed care organization. So simple things like that to me.
Streamline the system.
Some of it. Many of the things in this bill were actually mentioned by CMS, the Center for Medicaid Services, as reasons why they wouldn't approve our RFP for extending CanCare the next year. I am very confident that we can pass this reform bill through the Senate committee, and we have been working on these issues for years. The CanCare Oversight Committee has heard complaints like we don't have an effective ombudsman, and that's part of the bill, and on and on. And there's it's time to get something done, and we can get it done. The lieutenant governor has put together some new task force that he's saying they're coming to me and saying, well, they'll fix it. Well, too little too late. It's time to move on. Medicaid expansion, the bill is moving through the House. I understand it should get to the floor. I think that's the goal, so that it can be properly debated like good governing is. And we'll see where it goes. On the Senate side, it will be much more difficult. People's main concern, or so they say, is, the Trump administration is going to eliminate Medicaid expansion anyway, and why do it? And the answer to that is critical. If we go to a block grant program from the federal level, we, as Kansans, do not want to be at the end of the line of the funding, the bottom tier. And how else can they decide who can get the money except based on where you were prior to? I've thought and thought and thought, and I can't figure out how else they can do it that would be, quote, fair or reasonable or even approachable. So our goal, not only is it to take care of Kansans and the moral obligation we have, but is to get us in a place so that if we go to block grants, we're at least being covered for what we need in the state relative to other states.
So as someone who's watched CanCare very closely over the years, and you weren't on the oversight committee, but you were there at every
meeting.
I was there at every meeting.
Yeah, because it matters to me.
And so you've heard a lot of the issues that were in that CMS report had been highlighted at some of those hearings. How did you feel about the Brownback administration's initial response, which was just to point the finger at President Obama, who was in the last week of his presidency, and just accuse him of that this is some sort of a political shot at Sam Brownback?
We've seen that before from our administration, and probably the primary reason they've been opposed to anything in the Affordable Care Act at all is because it was Obama. That was lame, and you go look at, we've got statistics to show that there was never any targeting. It was equal for who got approved and who didn't, Democrat states, Republican states. None of that was actually able to be proven to be true. And, you know, who knows? But with all the problems we've seen for all these years, I couldn't believe they didn't shut it down sooner, or at least say you've got to fix these things. So, you know, hopefully with pressure from the upper level and pressure from actually the legislature, we can make some of these things be fixed and take appropriate care of our citizens.
We have to leave it there. Brian Lauer from the Kansas City Star, always good to have you back at this table.
Thanks for having me. Take care
of your mug.
I'll guard it with my life.
Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp, and you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you like to download your podcasts. You can also find us on kcur.org/statehouseblend. Our friends over there at Up to Date with Steve Kraske clear out a little room for us every Tuesday at 11 a.m. You guys on the NPR One app? I bet you are. And if you are, you can search for Statehouse Blend in Explore, and then remember to tap follow. If you like what we do, you can always leave a little review for us over on the iTunes. If you're a fan of the Twitter, and if you are, you should be following Brian Lowry. What's your Twitter handle?
It's Brian Lowry 3. There were a couple guys ahead of me, so I had to put the I'm not like the third or anything, but that was just the number that Twitter.
Yeah, there's two ahead of you. You know what? We'll just get those guys knocked off. You can follow Brian, you can follow me. I'm at Sam Zeff. And my co-host, Brian Ellison, over there on Statehouse Blend, Missouri. You can follow him. He's at PTS Brian. I'm Sam Zeff. I'll see you around the radio.